Welcome, you wonderful, purposeful, and beautiful humans, to Hope Still Wins. I'm your host, Ben Higgins. Hope Still Wins is a place where we get to know thought leaders from diverse backgrounds and differing worldviews to help us feel less alone, more connected, and move us to become a better world together. Each week, I'll be interviewing inspiring and relatable guests in attempts to get to know their hearts, celebrate their stories, and explore the concept of hope to hear how and if it has played a role in their lives. Ultimately, answering the question, does hope still win? If so, why? And if not, why not? This week, I'm sitting down with one of the most inspiring and incredible humans I've ever met, Saleika Jihad. Saleika is an Emmy Award-winning journalist and celebrated TED speaker, the author of the instant New York Times best-selling memoir, Between Two Kingdoms, which walks us through her journey of healing and self-discovery after a diagnosis of leukemia at the age of 22 and given only a 35% chance of survival. Saleika's connection to the present moment and her zeal for life is something I know you'll feel in this episode, and I'm one that is grateful that I got the opportunity to experience and learn from her, and I know many of you will feel the same way. In this episode, Saleika and I talk about being stripped of our identity and how to show up once it's gone. The quest to find purpose within limitations. Reimagining our relationships to risk. And how living is creating the act we all have the chance to participate in. After listening to this conversation, the team and I would love to hear this question. Where you believe we can find hope and purpose within life's limitations, whether temporary or permanent. As you may have guessed, this is our question of the week, and I invite you to respond on Instagram at Hope Still Wins in the comments or direct message us. As always, I'm excited to hear your responses, and we'll be sharing a few in a later episode. Now, many of you wrote in to answer the question proposed in episode 7 with Terrence Lester, and I want to take a couple of moments before we jump into this week's episode to share a few of your responses. And as a reminder, the question was, how can you be a distributor in your community? The amazing organization Colorado Kids Belong encouraged us to open our heart and home to kids in foster care or wrap around a family fostering. I've been able to be around Colorado Kids Belong, and it's something so incredible, so deep, that you're really changing, enhancing, and working within the lives of kids who do feel like outsiders, who do feel pushed away. But when you invite them in, or you just wrap your arms around those families, you're giving a level of support that will change lives. Zana says, support local businesses as things begin to go back to normal. Yes! Many of them had a rough year, and our support will give them monetary means and energy to come back stronger. As a small business owner myself, I cannot agree more. Please go out and support these businesses. It's been a long year, a confusing year, a disorienting year, and these businesses are trying to survive. If they've made it this far, they fought hard to get there. So what we can do is go out and support them. Thank you to everyone who submitted responses. I'm excited to continue to hear how you choose to impact your local communities as the year goes on. Well, thank you again, but it's time. Yes, it is time. Let's jump into my conversation with Saleika Jihad. Saleika, thank you for joining Hope Still Wins.
It's my joy and my honor.
Just to get us started here, if you can, and we're going to dive into your story and hopefully in depth ways here over the next few minutes, but do you mind for everybody out there sharing or listening, just sharing your story and how we got connected on this podcast?
Absolutely. So when I was 22, I was a recent college graduate, and I was working as a paralegal and trying to make my way, as we all do, in our early 20s. And I had these dreams of becoming a foreign correspondent. But before I was able to pursue that, about a year after graduating from college, I received a diagnosis of leukemia. And at that age, there's a way in which, you know, time feels limitless. You have time to figure things out. And all of a sudden, with this diagnosis, there was a realization that I didn't have time. I was given a 35% chance of survival. And it was one of those bifurcating moments in a life where there's suddenly a before and after. And even if you don't quite know what the future's going to bring, I had this very clear sense that the life I'd had before, the dreams, the person I'd been, were suddenly buried. And that whatever was ahead was going to be completely uncharted territory.
Well, thank you for sharing. And I want to start with talking about a little bit when in the midst of when everything was going on, before we move on to kind of what's happened now in your life, in this new season of life and all the incredible things. I mean, the incredible things you've done. You talk a lot about time. And I think that's a really interesting conversation for us to have and probably for people to listen to is, for you, what is your experience when you have to come to the realization that time is not limitless, that things are passing away? How did that feel for you as a 23-year-old?
I, you know, had always been a big dreamer. I loved to write in a journal, and I would fill my journal with lists of dreams and plans and ideas for who I wanted to become and what I wanted to do. But after I got sick, and especially when I was at my sickest, time became a kind of waiting room. I was sort of pinned to the present in this strange way where thinking about the past made me sad because it reminded me of the life that I'd had and the life that I no longer had. But thinking about the future was an equally scary exercise because I didn't know if I was going to exist in that future. And instead, I found myself in this kind of liminal space where, you know, I couldn't look in the rear view mirror. I couldn't look too far ahead. And really, you know, I couldn't think beyond the next biopsy or blood test. And it was this kind of forced experience of being grounded in the now.
I could imagine too, like you, I mean, as you said, you're getting out of college. You have a prestigious degree. The future is bright, yet unknown. And everything kind of comes to a halt. And I wonder how many people out there can relate with this over the last year, even where all these things were kind of churning, everything was happening, and then everything comes to a halt. And I mean, for me personally, a lot of what I put my identity in was kind of stripped away. And still to this moment, I'm recovering or trying to process who am I when everything stops? Did you have that experience?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I was very much swept up in the anxiety of accomplishment, and I measured my self-worth on my grades, on that prestigious degree, on the idea of leading a certain kind of career. And all of a sudden, none of that really mattered anymore. And I felt kind of stripped down to my most primal, simple self. And I also felt really angry. You know, we've all had the experience of going on social media and feeling a sense of FOMO. But for me, that felt heightened. I was watching my friends go to graduate school and start careers and travel the world and date and go to parties and all the other, you know, big and small milestones of being in your 20s. But meanwhile, I was in a hospital room. My you know, first chemotherapy treatments didn't work. I was doing an experimental clinical trial and I was in medical isolation, which meant I couldn't leave my room. I couldn't open the windows. Anyone who entered had to suit up in what looked like a hazmat suit. And I didn't just feel profoundly isolated, but I felt stuck. And it felt like the world was kind of moving on. And you know, in that first year in particular, I really struggled to figure out how to participate in the world and what I could do from my hospital bed. Maybe it sounds cheesy or earnest, but I wanted to feel like if I landed on the wrong side of those odds, that I wasn't just going to be remembered as someone else's sad story of unmet potential. It felt like I'd spent my whole life preparing for a life, and then I hadn't actually been able to live it. So that sent me on a quest to figure out what I could do within my limitations, what I could do from a hospital bed. And that forced me to let go of any expectations I had of what I was going to do and how I was going to do it. Because, you know, this dream of becoming a foreign correspondent wasn't going to be possible. There was no way I was going to be able to travel or interview other people. So instead, I began to think about what I could write from my hospital bed. And in the end, I ended up reporting from the front lines of that hospital bed and a New York Times column in a video series called Life Interrupted. But I should just say, you know, it took me a long time to get there. That first year was really hard. And I remember, you know, reading memoirs or hearing stories about other cancer survivors who had gone on to do incredible things, like run ultra marathons or start research foundations. And as much as I admired them, they also made me feel really bad about myself because I felt like I wasn't doing a good job of suffering well, of suffering productively. And I think it's important to talk about that because sometimes we hear these success stories and we think they must have something that I don't. But it was a long process for me to figure out how I could begin to kind of creatively engage with what had happened to me and maybe even make something useful out of it.
Can we dive a bit into that concept of suffering well, but also the jealousy, the anger, the emotions that kind of circle around us when we are watching other people and we're like, they're thriving and I just can't figure it out. Like, I can act it, I can show it on my social media, but internally, like, I just feel like I'm missing something. If you just said you went through that. So can you walk us through that process?
I think at first I felt a lot of shame around those feelings of anger or envy or frustration. I think especially for cancer patients, we call them brave, we call them inspiring. And that's a lot of pressure. And I didn't really feel deserving of those descriptors because I hadn't asked for this diagnosis. I would never have chosen it. And I didn't really feel like it was praiseworthy. I was just doing what I think most people would do in my circumstance, which was trying to survive. But as a friend of mine, Nadia Boltz-Weber, says, the best disinfectant for shame is sunlight. So the second I started writing about that anger, about those frustrations, about that feeling of being stuck, it kind of alchemized it and it no longer felt like anger. It felt like an interesting subject that I wanted to examine, that I wanted to understand better. And so the second I wrote about it, the second I held those things up to sunlight, they ceased to be, you know, those feelings ceased to be those feelings.
A beautiful story of confession. And I think maybe at the at the basis level, that's what confession's all about. You know, for me in my life, it's the things that I've held so closely, that I felt so guilty of, that I felt so shameful of. When I finally express those through writing them down, through admitting them to myself, is when the healing begins.
It's so true. And, you know, we live in a culture that tells us to have thick skin, to be tough. And I think in a way, that makes it difficult for us to be vulnerable, to share the unvarnished truth of the dilemma of being a human being. And without, you know, realizing it then, I was tapping into something that would end up being the through line in a lot of my work, because when we dare to share vulnerably and openly and honestly, whether it's in the privacy of a journal or a confessional booth, or you're sharing it with the world in some kind of public way, it creates a reverberation. That vulnerability begets vulnerability begets vulnerability. And it's been my experience that when we do that, we learn again and again that we're more alike than we are different.
Hey, Hope Still Wins listeners. Most of you know that this show is part of an amazing network of podcasts called That Sounds Fun Network. I love personally being a part of this community, so I wanted to tell you about another podcast that's on the network called Dadville. Fellow musicians and friends Dave Barnes and John McLaughlin share their journey of life, love, and the pursuit of awesome daddying on this weekly podcast. You'll get your fill of dad jokes, laughs, and heartfelt conversations while these dads and their guests talk about the journey of life and fatherhood. Episodes release every Tuesday. You'll hear personal stories from other awesome dads like Matthew McConaughey, John Mark Comer, and Ben Rector, just to name a few. Make sure you go and subscribe now to Dadville so you don't miss an episode. So coming out of that, you started writing this column, and there was a community, there was connection being built around this column where people reading this who were currently dealing with cancer or a terrible diagnosis, or maybe not at all. They just were reading your story and relating to it because of the reporting that you were doing. But a lot of people at this moment, from my understanding, started to connect with you through this column.
So the column went live when I was in the bone marrow transplant unit. I was preparing to undergo this incredibly risky procedure, and just writing the columns was such a physical challenge for me. I would write in these like 5 or 10 minute bursts from bed, staggered throughout the day. And I don't think I gave much thought to what would happen once the columns were out. I think I hoped that they would feel resonant, that they might provide some companionship to other young people dealing with life-threatening illness. But what really surprised me was that so many people related to the title of the column, which was Life Interrupted. And I heard from all kinds of people having all kinds of life interruptions, people who were going through divorces or who had lost a job or who were dealing with some other kind of trauma. And I think, you know, for most of us, if we live long enough, we have experiences where our life gets upended in some kind of way, or some, you know, grief or loss that brings us to the floor. And especially after this last year that we've had, I think we've all had globally an experience of a life interruption. But it was so valuable for me to read these different stories, especially at a time when I was confined to a hospital room. It felt like a kind of conduit to the outside world. And And those letters for me that I received ended up taking me on all kinds of adventures, but really they were such a source of sustenance and connection and camaraderie at a time when otherwise I think I would have felt profoundly alone.
So you choose, as soon as you went into remission, you chose to hit the road and visit some of the people that had written you these letters and that you had connected with from the hospital room. You chose to get in person to person with them, face to face. Why did you make that decision to do that? I mean, I think I read where it took you 15,000 miles across the world to meet these people face to face. So why was that the decision? You said, this is the next best step. This is the thing I have to do.
So for about 4 years of my life, when I was in treatment, the goal was to be cured. And I always thought that if I reached that point, it would feel like a huge celebratory milestone. But when I actually got there, it didn't feel that way at all. I was carrying the wreckage of those 4 years in the kingdom of the sick in my body and my heart. I was grieving the loss of friends I'd made in treatment who hadn't survived. I was grieving the loss of a relationship that hadn't been able to withstand the stress of, living through illness for as long as I did. But more than that, I had no idea who I was. I very quickly realized I couldn't return to the person I'd been pre-diagnosis. And of course, I was no longer a cancer patient, but I didn't know who I was and what the future held for me. And I was more lost in a way than I'd ever felt before. But the biggest thing I realized in those months when I first got out of treatment was that my relationship to fear and to risk had dramatically changed. Before my diagnosis, I was someone who had always loved to travel, who was fiercely independent. But after treatment, I no longer felt safe in my body. And more than that, I realized that I'd gotten comfortable in the hospital ecosystem. I understood that world. I belonged. It was the outside world, the world of the living, that felt daunting and foreign and frightening. And I came to the conclusion that if I didn't do something drastic, I was going to stay in a small, safe, stuck place. And I knew that I needed to challenge myself to go out into the greater expanses of the world, to learn to be independent, to reimagine, that relationship to risk and to safety, and to figure out what was on the other side of that fear. So that's what I did. I learned how to drive. And a month later, I borrowed a friend's car and I set out on the road with my dog, Oscar. And I really tried to think of this road trip as a kind of ritual to help me cross the distance between no longer and not yet. And those letters I'd received and the people that I visited were a kind of breadcrumb trail back to the kingdom of the well.
I want to pause you here because you said a couple things that I really want to dive into. And one of the themes that you just spoke about is choosing to become uncomfortable. Your comfort was to what you were just saying was in a hospital room. Out in the world felt uncomfortable. It felt foreign. It felt daunting. Meeting with people face to face, I'm sure, felt awkward. Like your social skills had probably decreased over a few years because you didn't have people sitting with you in the midst of you all the time. Why did you feel like it was the right thing to do to choose discomfort, and what were you hoping that would bring?
I was already in a place of discomfort. I was, deep and in a place of depression and anxiety. I you know, the way I write about it in the book, I say that when the ceiling caves in on you, you no longer assume structural stability. You have to learn to live along fault lines. And that's how I felt. You know, every time I would see a bruise on my shin, my heart would drop. And I would think, is this a sign that my illness is back? Every time I, you know, tried to be a normal 27-year-old girl and to go out dancing with friends or something, I'd pay for it with 3 days in bed because I was still so physically weak. And I understood that to not try to re-enter the world, as uncomfortable and as scary as that might have felt, was to choose a kind of life that was the very opposite of what I'd fought so hard for. And, you know, at my sickest, when I would be doing these kind of torturous treatments, I would tell myself to live a good life, a meaningful life, a happy life. Otherwise, what's been the point? And I think that same thought was what drove me to try to kind of alter the course of my becoming, to, in a way, experiment on myself after years of being experimented on by doctors, and to really see if there might be a way for me to actively participate in the creation of whatever that next chapter was going to be for me.
And where did it spit you out? Like today, as you sit here, and as you've had a huge impact, and we're going to talk about the projects in just a bit, that you've accomplished that have impacted millions. But as you did choose that path, you walked through that path on the tour to see all these people, to meet with them, that changed you. You pushed into discomfort, even though you were already there, but you said, I'm going to experiment a bit. Where did that end? Or where is it at now?
Yeah. So, you know, I think when I left home for the road, I hoped that I would come out on the other end of it feeling like I was back in the kingdom of the well. And in a way, that didn't happen, right? The fatigue, the compromised immune system, the sort of imprints of my illness on my body, all of that chased me across state lines. And when I emerged from that trip, I realized that I was still in that in-between place, but I had a really different orientation to it. I had kind of learned to make a home for myself in that wilderness and to embrace it. And I got back and ended up spending the next couple of months in a little log cabin in Vermont. And I started writing. I started writing about those encounters on the road and the people I visited. I started writing about that experience of feeling stuck. And what ended up coming out of that was my first book, Between Two Kingdoms. But none of that necessarily felt obvious to me at the time. I didn't really know what I was writing or what it would amount to. And I think often, you know, the best projects, the most honest ones, come from a place of needing to do something and putting in the work without really knowing where it's going to lead or if anyone's going to care or what's going to come out of it. But I was in a place of following my curiosity and writing toward the questions that I myself was trying to answer.
Are you looking to make a meaningful lifelong connection with someone who shares your beliefs? If so, then you've got to try Christian Mingle. With over 15 million Christian singles, Christian Mingle is unlike any other faith-based dating site. Their ability to help members make quality connections is what sets them apart. They have robust profiles and personalization features that help you connect with other like-minded members. Plus, their suite of communication tools help you meet more people and make deeper connections. Finding your true love is one of life's greatest adventures. So, discover why so many Christian singles find love at christianmingle.com/hope. That's christianmingle.com/hope. Between Two Kingdoms, which is a New York Times bestseller. Congratulations on that, by the way. Huge accomplishment. You might not have known it at the time that you're writing it, but people did read it. They have grabbed hold of it, and some people from the reviews read this book as most people do, but some people read this book as a life breath into them every time, and it's a piece that relates. It's a piece that inspires, encourages, but also shares a lot of truth. Do you mind explaining what that title meant? Where did it come from?
It's a reference to a line by the brilliant author Susan Sontag. And she talks about how we all have dual citizenship in the kingdom of the sick and in the kingdom of the well. You know, I really struggled with that concept. I'm of the opinion that we need to do away with that kind of binary thinking, because for a long time, I felt like I needed to slot myself into one kingdom or the other, but I didn't really fit. You know, on paper, I'm better. I've been cancer-free for almost 6 years now, but off paper, I was still grappling with the long-term imprints of this experience. I still, you know, have certain limitations that I've had to find creative workarounds. And what I began to understand and to believe is that, you know, as we live longer and longer, most of us exist somewhere in the messy middle, depending on the day, depending on the season in our life. And to stop striving for this constant perfect state of wellness was liberating. It allowed me to accept myself as I was, however I was feeling that day, and not just to kind of make peace with some of those struggles, but to see them as opportunities and invitations to push deeper into and to understand better and to make something out of. So that idea of in-betweenness, it has really been a kind of guiding philosophy for me, not just in my own life, but it's also in a way been my beat as a writer. I'm fascinated by the people and places and topics that kind of elude easy categorization, that live in the shadows and that are hard to define or maybe taboo to talk about.
I'm going to ask a question that will probably come off offensive.
Good.
But I want to ask it because I want to hear your answer. And so this is a contrast to how we typically see the world. But the question that I'm very interested in is, as you've now moved into this season of life where you're better, as you look at the chapter before the diagnosis, you had huge dreams and expectations and things that you're working hard for. The diagnosis hits, and I see it from my perspective, and I could be wrong, but as I see it, it was that pivot point. It was the liminal space. It was a period of time where things were shifting. And now you're, for lack of a better way to describe it, you're in a season where the liminal space is moving behind you, and you're in a place of outside of the diagnosis. And so as you've used this story to tell and to share and to relate, has there been at any point a joy in the diagnosis, a joy in the illness, because it's done so much for who you are now?
I don't want to minimize the like great sorrow and trauma of living through an illness. And at the end of my road trip, I went and visited a guy on death row by the nickname of Little GQ. His name is Quinn Jones. Never been sick, but who kind of related to these experiences of isolation and staring down your mortality. And at the end of the visit, he asked me if you could take it all back, would you? And I couldn't answer him in the moment, but I thought about it as I drove those remaining miles. And the answer that I arrived to is that, you know, of course I would do everything to spare my parents of the pain of, you know, having a very sick child. I would do everything to spare any of my loved ones the struggles and stress and financial hardships and emotional hardships that came with that experience. But abstracted from its impact on the people around me, I don't think I would reverse my diagnosis if I could. It heightened everything. It heightened the good and the bad. And it also, you know, pushed me, like I said earlier, down to my most primal, savage self. And to have that experience of being confronted with the facts of your mortality, with the fact that none of us have limitless time, to really have everything stripped down to the bone was a really valuable experience. I keep thinking back as we're talking to a period when I was sick, when I had, you know, really limited energy and I could do three things every day. I could, you know, write an email or see a visitor, or, you know, watch a TV. That was all I could do, three things. And because of those limitations, I had to get really specific about what I wanted to do during my day and who I wanted to spend it with in a way that I don't think I would have thought about if I had, you know, lots of energy and felt that sense of limitless time. And I see that as a great privilege, and it's, you know, informed the way I live my life now. To know that, you know, our life is a terminal condition, and to be aware of how fleeting our time here is, and to really bring into each day an awareness of what it is that feels most meaningful and who it is that you want to spend that time with, I think is something that's greatly enhanced my life. It's given me a kind of jeweler's eye.
Thank you for sharing that. Two final questions for you. In a book I came out with in February, I got to interview a young lady who was 22 years old who had suffered from cystic fibrosis. Her name was Annie, and I got to talk to Annie in her last couple weeks of life about what life looks like for her and what lessons she would share and what wisdom she's gained from this. And unfortunately, Annie's no longer with us, and she passed away at the age of 23. And so I do get to share that story in my book. But my final question to her, and I have it still in the text, was Annie, because she knew she was passing. There wasn't any question, and it was about a week before the final day, and I said, Annie, if you had a message to share, or if you could have done things differently, what would you tell people? Because I think one of the most impactful places that we can come from is a place where you do confront your mortality, because we all share that in common. And when we do see that, and when Annie saw that at 22 and just a bright human who had so much going for her, and when she had that at 22, there was a fear, there was an anxiety, but then there was a peace about it. What would your message be now that you are still here, and you faced your mortality, and you're moving in to who knows how many years left? what would be your message of things learned, of your message to anybody listening saying, this is what I'm taking with me?
I'm just sitting with Annie's story. It's so powerful, and I'm so sorry she's not here. I think, you know, the word mercy is coming to mind. We've been talking about, you know, the culture of busyness and the anxiety of accomplishment and this fear that, you know, someone else somehow has it figured out and you, for whatever reason, can't. And I've been in that place, and if I could travel back in time, I wish that my younger self could have extended a greater sense of mercy toward myself. The other thing that comes to mind is this notion of survival and living as a creative act. No matter where you are and what your limitations might be, to think of your life as a creative act has always been hugely helpful for me, to understand that I get to reimagine what my day contains, what my relationship to work is. Whether you're an artist or a writer, or, you know, you've never had any interest in being a creative person, we all have that creativity within us, and to be able to tap into that space of dreaming and of imagination, and to bring it to these difficult passages, is something that's really, you know, informed every aspect of my life and gotten me through my most difficult moments. That was a long, rambling answer. I'm still moved and thinking about Annie, so forgive me.
It's a beautiful answer. You, Nadia Boltz-Weber lives here in Denver, which is where I live. So I know her well. And I would say that you have been a little encouragement, a ray of sunlight for many, that I'm sure people are listening to this and listening to your answer that comes from the heart and comes off the cuff. There's no prep for that question. And going, there's much within that that shines bright into the hearts of those who are out there hurting, or maybe not hurting, but hearing it and taking your wisdom. Well, my final question for you, thank you so much for your time. And before I ask it, I do just want to highlight, and I'll do it many times here as we close out. But please, just research Suleika and her TED Talk and the book Between Two Kingdoms. It's incredible. It is life breathing. You can find her on social media. Just take some time and research and learn if you're listening to this. But final question for you. It's what the show is based on, and it's always interesting to hear the answers because some are for it, some are against it. But I just want you to be honest. Do you believe in all of this that hope still wins? If so, why? And if not, why not?
I believe hope must win. I think, you know, when you've been through a heartbreak, the impulse can be to armor your heart, to guard against the possibility of more suffering. You know, it's hard to open yourself up to hope and to love and to the accompanying loss or heartbreak that can come with that. But to live your life with a sense of hope and with an open heart, to me is really the only choice we have, because the alternative is not really a life. And I can't really think of a better response to life's sorrows than love and hope. Love and hope for the life you have, for the life you'd like to have, love and hope for the people around you. It's really been the North Star for me, no matter what kind of day I'm having, to invest my hope in a tomorrow that's even just fractionally better and more beautiful than the last.
Thank you so much for joining us on Hope Still Wins. You are, again, you are a ray of sunshine, and you are somebody who I'm so thankful can share your wisdom with so many. And we appreciate you here. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm so grateful. This is so fun.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode of Hope Still Wins. If you haven't already, please subscribe or follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed this conversation, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple and join the community over on Instagram at Hope Still Wins. As a reminder, our question from this episode is, where can we find hope and purpose within life's limitations, whether temporary or permanent? We're eager to hear your answers and invite you to join us on Instagram to share your thoughts and continue the conversation. We'll be choosing a few of your responses to share in a later episode. Well, hey friends, that's it for today. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for joining all of us over at this community. I am so pumped to continue to do Hope Still Wins and have you come along with us. I'm your host, Ben Higgins, and I'll see you next week.